Yes, oh, okay. I wondered, because I was going to ask.
Judiciary Committee will come back to order.
So you can take that.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's see. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, what would you like me to do here? I think, I don't know if, I'm sure the chair knows that a fiscal note was done, and I believe it relates to the Department of Health. It has to do with the registry.
Right.
The establishment of the donor registry. And so I think we can, I've been told we can safely eliminate on page 14, lines 4 and 5, having to do with the Department of Health. And because the Department of Public Safety is already involved with the driver's license piece of this. So that I think that would then negate the need for the fiscal note and for going to finance.
So, Senator Scheid, do you want to move to strike?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, I would. On page 14, I would move that we delete lines 4 and 5, and then I guess we have to, they will re-letter the other provisions. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, Senator Scheid. Any discussions on Senator Scheid? Senator Betzel.
Just a question, Madam Chair. I mean, I'm trying to see if eliminating lines 4 and 5 make any sense with the rest of the section, because it talks about the Department of Safety cooperating for the purpose of transferring for any registry that the state establishes. So it's hypothetical. Then, starting on line 10, it's quite prescriptive as to what the registry should do. So, I mean, if you eliminate the fact that there has to be a registry, having the requirement about what the registry is going to look like doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I don't know whether it may eliminate the fiscal note. It just doesn't make the rest of the section, read well.
Senator Scheid, Ms. Larson. Yes.
Madam Chair, committee members, actually, in the state of Minnesota, we already have a donor registry. This section is in there to encourage states to have a formal process for donor registration, and that is in place in Minnesota, and this would just allow that to continue.
Well,
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, if a registry already exists, should we not be referencing that registry in here somehow and then not have to require what the donor registry is going to be doing? If it exists, then this section needs some work to figure that out.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson?
Yeah, Senator Betzel. I think that the language does need to be in there in terms of what a registry must consist of. It does consist of that, but we want to make sure that's sustained moving forward, and these provisions for what a registry must have are important.
Madam Chair, Ms. Larson.
Senator Betzel.
If it already exists, what language can we have to refer to something that exists instead of referring to something? Because if you read this, how do we know that this is referring to what already exists? Shouldn't we be referring to something that's sitting there? You're telling me that it exists. Okay. How do we tie them together?
What is it?
What is it?
Yeah. Judge Davis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the expectation of the drafting committee that in a situation like we have in Minnesota, that the contract would in effect be a badge of approval of the existing registry, and in just in a way to keep it under some control. But there'd be no new money, so if we could, I think the language can be left in there, and the contract would be for free, in effect, because they...
Senator Scheid, I don't think that Senator Betzel is as opposed to the donor registry being here, I think we just need to clean up the language
a little bit.
So it's not vague.
I agree.
So, we'll be working on the bill for a little bit.
I'll withdraw that amendment for right now, and we'll try to get it.
Let's see if we can clean it up, and maybe as we're talking, Senator Betzel could even be helping us identify areas that would be all right. But if Judge Davis and Ms. Larson, if you could take a quick look at that to see what we can do to clean that up, we'll incorporate that into your amendment to delete the registration. Judge Davis.
Let me try to save Senator Betzel's as much energy as I can possibly save. The line four says the Department of Health may, and then you get down on lines 25 through 27. This section does not prohibit any person from creating or maintaining. So the status quo in Minnesota can be left. But if that status quo ever becomes inappropriate or inadequate, then the Department of Health can exercise the authority that's here. So it's covering it both ways.
I think they need to tell us, does it?
But I don't think there'd be any new money involved.
We understand that. We understand. I mean, we note that it won't imply that there's new money in there. It's just that if there's already a registry, then we shouldn't be so vague as to say any such registry when we already have a registry. So we'll take a look at the language as we continue. Any other comments or questions on any other section of the bill while this section is being looked over? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I wanted to... find it here. Turn to page 8. There's a list of individuals that can make the decision of an anatomical gift. And I think we're expanding that list in a few areas. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering why I can understand that the family, the immediate family, adult siblings, but once we start getting away from the immediate family and start moving into adult grandchildren, grandparents, not to mention adults who exhibited special care and concern, and any other person having the authority to dispose of the decedent's body. I'm wondering if you could maybe explain why those... First, are they an expansion of existing current
law? Madam Chair and Senator
Ms.
Limmer.
Larson?
Yep. This is mostly the same as existing language, but it does expand it to reflect various family situations. And it's important to note that this is a priority list. So if you... adult grandchildren, for example... they would be making the decision of donation if there is no spouse, no adult children, no parents, no adult siblings. So to make sure that there is an individual who is available and able to make a decision about donation after somebody who has not designated their wishes has passed away.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
How would someone reading this, if it became law, know that this list is a priority order list?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, that language is at the bottom, 7.
Oh, I see. Okay, I missed that. Gotta read things.
201.
But, Madam Chair, then
Senator Limmer.
There's also kind of a conflict resolution clause of sorts just below that, starting on lines, I think, 13 through 16. And then later on lines 17 and 18, there can be held an election. If an objection is known, the gift may be made only by a majority of the members of the class. Now, is that contrary to a priority order?
No.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that is not in contradiction. That would be, for example, if we get down to adult children of the decedent, there are 5 adult children. If one of those 5 adult children said, I'm really opposed to this donation, then we would have to go to what is the group looking for if 4 provide authorization, then donation could move forward.
Madam Chair,
Senator Lamont.
I'm a little concerned. We have a family decision. It's obviously an emotional one, wrapped up with kind of a time is of essence type thing. And you've got the family put together. They're trying to decide what's the best thing to do. And at the same time, you've got other people here that possibly could be in on that decision, couldn't they? If they were an adult who exhibited special care, would they fit into and intercede with this decision? I guess I'm trying to
Larson?
Define that a little.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's a very good question. They would not, because again, we're going down the priority list, and so if we get to adult children of the decedent, that's where we're at on the list. And so we're working with that group of individuals. And you're correct, that is a very emotional and difficult time, and that's the time that we sit down with the family and try to really process and work through where everybody's at and talk about their donation options and do what's in the best interest of the family. But this language about majority of class really helps to guide working through those conflicts, whereas right now we don't quite have that much clarity.
Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Is this an appropriate time to consider amendments?
I think that's where we're at, Senator Limmer.
I'd like to introduce the A3 amendment. And if everyone could turn to page 5, we can kind of get started on that.
I didn't hear what Senator Lamont.
Page 5.
First of page 5.
And the amendment? Or
the amendment is A3, but it makes reference to page 5, line 15.
Thank you.
Tell me about it. Add a new E.
If you go up to line 5, page 5, it begins to give you the reason why there's this list above line 15. If the donor or other person is physically unable to sign a record, the record may be signed by another individual at the direction of the donor, and then they give directions what the direction of the donor or other person and must, and then 1, be witnessed by 2 adults, state that has been signed and witnessed. There's a provision for revocation, suspension. D, an anatomical gift may be by will, takes effect upon the donor's death. And I'd like to add one more, a line E, that the making of an anatomical gift does not in itself authorize or direct a denial of health care. This is more comfort language, but I wouldn't want this provision of law to gain so much preference that we may sometime in the future may cause a denial of health care if someone did not sign an anatomical gift direction. Does everyone understand that?
Senator Lumber, can you give us an example?
Well, in a way, this is a hypothetical. You're looking toward a hypothetical. We want to ensure that someone's wish to donate organs is not interpreted to simply imply that a donor would like to have their health care stopped in order to best facilitate a harvest of organs, number one. Number two, I think this language may reassure those who might hesitate to want to donate their organs for fear that they'll not be given necessary treatment to sustain their life. And I don't think there should be a condition for health care if you're seeking health care to...
This is not a change in existing law. This is...
have some provision sometime in the future to require
a donation clause.
This
we should keep the autonomy of the individual separate and unique in the process of searching for health care.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that kind of raises a question in my mind just in terms of how this works. So say, for example, someone is on life support and wants to donate their organs and they're terminal. In other words, you know, the decision has been made that this person, maybe they're brain dead or whatever. At some point, you do continue that life support, I assume, long enough to be able to harvest organs in a way that would make them viable. So how do if the person has signed and authored something saying they want to be kept alive through a certain stage, you know, well, how does the interaction of all that work? And I guess I'm just wondering, is language like Senator Limmer's suggesting necessary, or is it just a reflection of existing law, and how does that work?
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Larson can answer that. I don't believe this language is found in current law, but I think it reflects probably the way it works now.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, committee members, you know, donation is not an option until death. I mean, that's just a fact in federal law and all the guidelines and standards that we are required to follow support that. I'll just very briefly walk you through the donation process. When there is a death in Minnesota, we're called. That's federal law. We have to be called, and we evaluate for potential for donation. If there is potential, then that's the time that we check if the individual had donor designation. That's also the time that we sit down and talk to the family and talk about donation options. So if an individual is brain dead, they're dead, and you're correct, the support is maintained to keep the organs viable through oxygen and blood flow until such time that they're surgically recovered so that they can go to the recipient. Does that? And I can go into more detail if you have more specific questions, but that's just a general overview of how the process works.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Davis.
I think that the amendment that we put on as an author's amendment really deals with this, that there's no artificial, that sometimes the life support has to be continued for the protection of the organs beyond where they would normally be used. And in that situation, there's a negotiation made between the person who's in charge of the decisions as to maintenance of the artificial life supports versus the person who's interested in maintaining those life supports only for the purpose of keeping the organ usable. And I think that takes care of the edge of this problem better than this amendment that you're offering, Senator Limmer. So it's really already on the bill.
Yep. Senator Neville?
Well, Madam Chair, as I read what Senator Limmer's trying to do here, I think he's trying to cover the situation where there is no health care directive, where there is no will that has a provision in it about body parts or, you know, no other health care directive. And he doesn't want, tell me if I'm reading this wrong, but you don't want the fact that I'm a donor on my driver's license by itself to authorize the stopping of health care.
Right.
So that will not be considered an authorization to take a person off a respirator, for example. There'd have to be other reasons for doing that than just the donor card. So that's a little different than I think you were explaining. We wouldn't be keeping it to preserve the organs. We'd be keeping it until the person dies a natural death.
Well,
that's the way I interpret it.
Right. Ms. Larson, though, under current law and under current practice, this situation that Senator Neville just described doesn't happen, right?
Madam Chair, committee members, no, it doesn't happen. And one thing that I might add that is important, I think will help put perspective to this, is we actually exist so this doesn't happen. So the people, the physicians, the medical providers who are caring for an individual and who are declaring death are not connected to us in any way. We're responsible simply for the management of the donation process and recovering organs. At the same time, the transplant center, the transplanting surgeons are separate. So there's three separate and distinct entities that are involved to ensure that there is a clear separation of care for patient and donation.
Senator Betzel?
Well, I was trying to recall the state of the law on healthcare directives. Obviously, if there's a healthcare directive, that should be followed. If it says, do not resuscitate, do not take any extraordinary measures to keep me alive, then that should be followed. If it says, keep me alive at all costs, you're supposed to follow that too. But for the situations where there is no guidance, it's a little bit tougher to do. I do recall a couple of years ago a case, and it was, I think it just preceded the health care directive statute, where there was an elderly lawyer, his wife was on life support. She had no chance of recovery, and the lawyer argued in Hennepin County Court that she would have wanted to stay alive. She would have wanted everything to be done. And the court said, don't take her off life support. And so they left her on life support simply because that was the representation of her husband. I mean, she died about a day after the court made its decision. But I don't think that adopting, this amendment would change the state of the law. I think the state of the law is if there's no health directive, I mean, they don't know what to do, but, I don't think having a donor card is going to hasten the declaration of death just because we're afraid that the organs are going to deteriorate if we don't hurry that process up. So I do have a question about the wording. I don't know if the words in itself are needed. I mean, I think that could be eliminated, but beyond that, I think that this doesn't really change the law as I understand it.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, I take those words.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I mean, I don't think that it's necessary, but I think, as Senator Limmer said, it's comfort language, and I think it's absolutely how it happens today. But I do sort of agree, though, with Senator Betzold about in itself, I think just a gift does not authorize or direct the denial of health care.
Senator Limmer will incorporate that into his A3 amendment.
in itself from line 3.
We'll incorporate that into the amendment. Any further discussions on the A3 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer. Anything else? Senator Neville.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, I want to ask a question on throughout this, we use the term power of attorney for health care. In the back of my mind, I thought we use health care directors now, don't we?
And I have that.
Should that not be throughout this document, we should change that term to health care directive?
I think so.
I thought we got rid of powers of attorney for health care.
No, there's something.
Ms. Larson, I had the power of attorney language circled all throughout the bill, and I had intended to ask about that when we were having the conversation about the directives. Is any directions?
Madam Chair, committee members, unfortunately, I don't have direction on that. I would maybe defer to Mr. Davies.
Judge Davies?
When we were drafting the bill, we presumed that was a generic term that would pick up whatever the term was in any state. The health care directive really is a power of attorney.
Right.
And
well, Madam Chair, I think we ought to just make it consistent because the health care directive has all the statutory necessities for execution and filling in the blanks of what the person wants or not. So I'd like to move that throughout the bill, wherever the term power of attorney for health care is referenced, we replace that with health care directive.
And we would give counsel latitude to
yes.
to do that.
Right.
And in instances where if there is a decision to make, counsel will consult with Senator Scheid.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Is that agreeable? Senator Olson? Should there be a cross-reference to the statute that defines?
With the cross-reference.
Yeah, that would be,
That will be incorporated into Senator Neville's motion. Senator Scheid, are you amenable to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes.
On Senator Neville's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an A2 amendment. And as that's being passed out, I'll direct you to the front page of the bill. And if I could direct you to lines 23 and 24, under the term of decedent. This definition can trigger some other debate that would probably go into a very large policy discussion. When one is starting to make reference to a fetus on line 24, one can begin to tiptoe into another issue. I'd like to clarify this and refer to current law when it comes to the death or the dispersion of anatomical gifts. The amendment takes everything after the word individual on line 22 and takes everything out beyond that and then installs this modified definition, including a stillborn infant or an embryo or fetus that has died of natural causes in utero, rather than simply a fetus. It clarifies it a little bit. We have other references in current law that I believe make reference to this very same definition.
It's an effort to keep it neutral.
I'd like your reaction to that.
Senator Scheid?
Sure. I know that it reflects current law. I would like, however, to, I'm not sure how to do this grammatically very well, but I would like to keep the new language on 22 and 23, whose body or part is or may be the source of an anatomical gift. So instead of deleting that language, could we, I'm this is off the top of my head, but could you say decedent means a deceased individual, including a stillborn infant, et cetera, whose body or part is or may be the source?
Madam Chair, you could do that, or you could simply leave the first sentence of the same period and then say the term includes, then going to the amendment, a stillborn infant or an embryo or fetus that has died of natural causes in utero.
Madam Chair, that's less cumbersome. I think it's better that
way. Why don't we, Senator Limmer, why don't you withdraw your A2 amendment, and then we'll have you make an oral amendment to the language that's on the page, because it seems that the oral amendment... It'll be cleaner and quicker.
All right.
Okay. So the Senator Limmer withdraws the A2 amendment, and now Senator Limmer moves that on page 1, line 23 of the bill, starting with in term includes a stillborn infant, after the word infant. Insert.
Delete the balance of that sentence on 23 and 24 and install...
Insert.
Or an embryo or fetus that has died of natural causes in utero, period.
So, and insert, or an embryo or fetus that has died of natural causes in utero.
That's correct.
Any discussion? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'll let the committee decide if you want to do that. I'm
Senator Olson.
Well, I wasn't going to speak to this. I just actually had my hand resting there. But as long as you called on me, I guess I would say that I support the amendment. It concerns me that without this amendment, the person who has the responsibility to make the decision under our order of priority would be, I believe, the parent in this situation. And I can see situations arising where it would be very difficult for a parent. For example, let's just say that you have one child with a significant illness that needs an organ donation or some tissue or something like that. And you might be in a real dilemma if we made it legal for you to potentially initiate a life just for the purpose of saving another life. And I think then we get into some real moral quandaries that I don't feel comfortable with. And so from my perspective, I feel more comfortable with the bill with this amendment in place.
Any further discussions? Ms. Larson, you are all okay with this language?
Madam Chair, yes.
All right. On Senator Limmer's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Anything else?
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I'd like to make just a technical amendment that I think helps it read better on Section 4. Who may make an anatomical gift?
What line?
Number
page
one.
Four.
Page 4, line 4.18 through 20. I think it would read more clearly if number 1 said the donor, any adult donor, and then number 2 would be a minor donor if the minor is emancipated or authorized under state law for a driver's license. So it's clear, you know, it seems to me that what the intent is adults and minors only if in certain circumstances, and then renumber 2, 3, and 4. Just to break out the minor, those little Roman numerals 1 and 2 don't apply to the adult. They only apply to the minor.
Yeah.
Senator Neville, can you repeat your...
Well, number 1 would say an adult donor. Mm-hmm. Number 2 would say a minor donor if the minor is, colon, and then keep the Roman numerals 1 and 2. And then 2 would become 3, et cetera. Renumber 2, 3, and 4. I think that's just a technical change. Yeah, just to make it more clear.
Madam Chair, I think that reads better. Even though I don't have it exactly.
Senator Neville moves those changes. Council will insert those changes in the report. Senator Shai, would you like council to read that back to you?
Chair, please. Please.
Ms. Pondius.
Madam Chair, members, I'll just read how it would read. Basically, starting on line 4.18, clause 1 would read an adult donor, and then it would be semicolon, then it would be clause 2 would be a minor donor if the minor is, colon, and then the other clauses would be renumbered.
That is the amendment. It is the intent of your bill that a 16-year-old then can give consent on his own without his parents.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members.
Ms. Larson.
That is the intent of the bill, and that reflects current law. What it's saying is a minor can document their consent to donate on a registry or driver's license. Elsewhere in the law, and I can point it out if you want to, it says that upon death, the parents can revoke that.
Oh, it does. Mm-hmm. That's still in the bill?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
On Senator Neville's motion, any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Madam Chair.
The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, when we've gone over this area of law before, we've had a lot of discussion on the possibility of revoking one's original intent. And we've had discussion on it over the years to the point that we did make some changes when it was found that the Department of Public Safety would actually get into verbal arguments with people on the telephone arguing that they should not revoke their intention. And hopefully that's been resolved. But could you step through the process if someone had previously made in some type of statement and now they want to revoke? How do they do that under this bill?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Shad.
Madam Chair, is Senator Limmer talking about the person who is going to die? The person who knows they're going to die before the death.
Right.
Okay.
Senator Scheid, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, committee members, obviously, depending on how you make a document of gift would be dependent upon how you revoke it. And this does talk about that. You can remove that from your driver's license, and that is, in fact, a revocation of the gift. As in current law, a revocation is not equal to a refusal. It just means that you no longer have made a gift of donation. But this law, actually, and if you go to page 6, section 7, really clarifies how an individual can make a refusal to donate. Also in lines 31 and 32, it talks about a refusal to make an anatomical gift bars all other persons from making an anatomical gift. That's not in current law. That is strengthened.
Madam Chair,
in
an earlier amendment, did we take a part of that section 7 out, or am I getting confused on another reference? That's still in. And what lines are you referring to there?
Madam Chair, Senator Limiter, on page 6, lines 6.31 and 31 and 32. So starting at line 6 is the whole section on how an individual makes a refusal to donate. Those last two lines I point out because that's the part that says anyone is barred from overturning that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limiter.
I see that the individual can sign a record or a record signed by the individual. I'm referring to line 6.10 and down. Individuals will, whether or not the will is admitted to probate, any form of communication by the individual during the individual's terminal illness addressed to at least two adults. And then you have another reference on line 20 to be witnessed by at least two adults. Why do we have all of the two adult references in here? Why can't just an individual make a simple statement himself and go forward? I see that it's a terminal illness condition, but I'm assuming the person is still capable of communication. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson?
Am I reading this wrong?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I would think you would want it validated. I mean, you would want it witnessed. Mm-hmm. You may sign it and not have... I think you don't have to have a witness to your signature, but if you're speaking it, it probably should be to two parties, and I think one of them should be a disinterested party. But so that... Yes, Mr.
Judge Davies.
Lines 10 through... Well, 10 through 11, those two lines are just a straightforward refusal. The individual signs it, and it's over and done with. But on line 12 deals with situation where the person is unable to act for themselves. In other words, they give instructions to somebody else. Then you need the two witnesses.
I see. Okay.
So that's a rare circumstance.
Ms. Larson, can you go to section 12, which is on page 10 of the bill? Can you talk with us a little bit through that that section?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, this is the section that talks about how a document of gift is located so that it can be fulfilled. So this is very consistent with current law, but first talks about law enforcement. So if a first responder is working with somebody and they find on their evidence that there is a driver's license with the donor designation.
And we changed the persons to first responders, right, in that section?
Yes, in the amendment.
And then... Ms. Larson, a couple of quick questions on Section 16 and 17 of the bill. There is a felony for the sale or purchase of parts prohibited. And I just want to draw that to the members' attention. I believe what we're trying to do here is to prohibit people contracting for the sale of their body parts in the future, at a future time. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's correct. It's federal law, it's state law, it's illegal to buy and sell organs, and this is to make sure that that doesn't happen, either by an individual who's trying to sell their organ, their family, or I guess us as a procurement organization, that would certainly be a felony. Section 17 is also a little, adds some new felony language, saying it's a felony to falsify documents to make donation a possibility.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Madam Chair, committee members, I've never seen this happen, but I think what this is going to is if, you know, I decided that I wanted Judge Davies to be a donor, then I would forge a donor card on his behalf so when he dies I can move forward with donation. I think that's what it's getting to, but again, I've certainly not seen that
but
happen.
But you don't have to.
Yeah. Yes, I know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Both Senator Olson and I are on the Pensions Commission, which is going to start at 7 over in the SOB, so I don't know how much longer we can be working on this, but both of us are going to have to bail in short order. So.
I understand, Senator Betzel. Before you leave, I just want to make sure that I bring that to the members' attention. I don't know if that raises a concern for any members in the committee in terms of the amounts or, you know, the...
Well, Madam Chair, before I'll make a... Let me go back to Section 20 on the registry. I think I might be able to offer an amendment that might help make this work a bit. Let me just throw this out there, and if it doesn't, as I say, I'm going to have to leave. But if the idea is to delete Section 4 and 5 so they are not, the Department of Health is not going to have to establish a registry or a new one. On 14.6, I'm not sure I like the language cooperate with a person that administers any donor registry. I think we can change that to the Department of Public Safety shall and put provide donor information to. Strike the rest of that line and continue on. Any donor registry that the state establishes, contracts for, or recognizes, etc. And then eliminate lines 25 to 27 because that simply says that, you know, it doesn't prohibit any person from creating a new one that's not under contract, but it must comply with. Well, I think that the language under 6 through 9 provides that it has to be recognized by the state for the purpose of transferring any donor registration. So I don't think we need 25 to 27 because I think the language is already covering it in the first part. So if that's okay, I'll, you know, if people have a problem with that, then, you know, I'm not going to stick around much longer to, you know, work it out, but...
Judge Davies.
But, yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would hope that the committee would not strike lines 25 through 27. This is a situation where you may have a public registry, but the interstate and so on, you might have a much better operation. And this is what makes sure that the state does not get in the way. Something that's even better.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think it's important to note we at LifeSource do have a donor registry that we manage. The primary registry in the state of Minnesota is the driver's license, but we have an online system, so if people don't have it on their license, they can go online and register. Both systems are checked at the time of donation, and so if you delete these lines, that would change the system that exists in our state now.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to make one point, and I'm leaving. As I say, I think that lines 7 and 8 talk about Department of Public Safety recognizing a database for the purpose of transferring to the donor registry. So if it's not something the state recognizes, I don't know why they should be transferring it. You know,
Senator Betzel, Senator Scheid will work with you to make sure that we get clean language.
Sure.
Thank you for your suggestion. Senator Scheid, you'll work with Senator Betzel.
Absolutely,
on that.
Madam Chair.
I think on this section,
Yes.
We'll make sure that when it gets to the floor, the members of this committee will know that that's it's with respect to this, because Senator Betzel and Senator Olson has to leave. Senator Limmer.
I wanted to go back to page 4 and 5 of the bill. Section 5, located on page 4, one can certainly make the wishes known of a donor by making a notation on a Minnesota driver's license or identification card. And I want to bring you back to the next page over, page 5, when we're talking of amending or revoking. Could one create a conflict by not recognizing an altered or a previously revoked driver's license notation when one wants to revoke? You're sending an intent to revoke. Are you creating a conflict between, let's say, I had a driver's license that had an X claiming I'm a donor, and I'm getting wheeled into the emergency room, and I'm telling people, don't take my organs. Let's say I'm just a little highly emotional, and I don't want that to happen. Then I pass out, and I'm not revived. Is that an adequate revocation of what's on my driver's license?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe so, because one of the ways to make a refusal is a verbal indication to at least two individuals. In the most recent documentation is what needs to be followed. And so your verbal intention is more recent than your driver's license designation.
Madam Chair, could you show us where it says that?
Page 6.
That a verbal witness...
Madam Chair, it's back what we discussed.
Section 7.
Section 7?
Page 6, Section 7.
Well, Section 7 is a refusal. That's different than a revocation.
Madam Chair, committee members, you're correct, and my understanding of what Senator Limiter was just talking about is that is a refute, that he refused.
No, I think what Senator Limiter was asking was if you had it on your driver's license, so you are a donor, and then you want to revoke it just before you go in the operating room, how do you revoke it? Can you revoke it verbally?
Yes.
Where is that language?
Look on page 8.
Okay.
Page 8, section 10 is manner of making, amending, or revoking. In line 29, may be amended or revoked orally.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
What's the difference between section 6 and 10? It looked like section 10 is for revoking after the person has died, and section 6 is for revoking before their death. So I've been trying to work through this as people are talking. Wouldn't Section 10 relate to the situation where maybe the donor or the person had been a donor, but then his health care agent after the fact, after death, said, I'm revoking it? And so what Senator Limmer's situation is would be covered under Section 6. If they want to revoke before the donor's death. And I didn't see anything.
Chair.
Looks like you need it in
Senator Scheid.
Chair, at the very top of page 6, I think, lines 1, 2, and 3, was not made in a will by any form of communication during the illness, but addressed to at least two adults, at least one of whom is a disinterested witness. So they may revoke.
Ah, that's it.
I think.
That's it. Thank you.
So.
Yep.
Senator Scheid, on page 11, on line 5 and 6, there is a reference to a person is not subject to criminal or civil liability for failing to discharge the duties imposed by this section, but may be subject to administrative sanctions. I think that this goes back to that section that we talked about, the first responders and their responsibility to search for the document.
Madam Chair.
I'm a little bit concerned that we're making it a shall and we're sort of imposing administrative sanctions on them. And I'm wondering, from a law enforcement standpoint, are we sending are we setting unrealistic expectations that, you know, our law enforcement, our first responders have to know about this and that they have to somehow make that a priority, perhaps when they're kind of in the midst of an emergency, that they still have to keep this at the back of their minds? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I believe it's current law until you get to the language you talked about on 11.6. I believe we have language in current law that says a person who fails to discharge the duties imposed is not subject to criminal or civil liability. I don't believe we have the administrative sanction language in current law. Am I correct?
And I think maybe, you know, perhaps because of the shall we have in the first sentence in the...
Well, Madam Chair, that, and that is current law, too. It does
right,
say shall.
Right,
yes.
And I'm thinking that that makes sense when you put the shall with the shall not be subject to criminal or civil liability for failing to do it, because we're telling them to do it. But now we're adding new language that says, but we will impose administrative sanctions on you. And I think then we're telling them they have to do something. And it was okay when we said we won't hold you liable if somehow you can't discharge that. But now we're saying, but we may sanction you administratively. So I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, and I don't know. I mean, Judge Davies will know, but I don't know if that's a local agency that would, and it does say may, so it's permissive, but I'll let Judge Davies respond.
Judge Davies?
It's the same thing as any other discipline that might be administered to the person. Yet you don't follow the rules, you don't follow orders, you're subject to administrative discipline. And this is one of the responsibilities, and I assume that if they did it maliciously or in particular bad way, that the sanction might be particularly serious, but otherwise it'd just be a disciplinary letter in your file, for example. That's what this is authorizing, is that kind of a sanction on failure to do what you're supposed to do.
Well, I understand that piece of it, and I think that that's the gist of my objection, which is that we're telling them that they have to do this, and I can see in an instance if the individual is at a hospital or in some other context, but in a multiple vehicle collision, our law enforcement, our first responders ought to have a number of other things on their mind, and this shouldn't rise to the level of being paramount because they might be subject to an administrative sanction for not fulfilling this shall that we're imposing here. But and so if you would like to do that, I would hope, Senator Scheid, that you would consider perhaps changing the shall to may, or if you'd like to keep the shall in place, I think that perhaps we ought to look at eliminating the new language and just keeping what was there.
No shall.
But, of course, that's, you know, up to the members of this committee to...
Madam Chair, I think I prefer the shall. You know, I think that it's current. I think it's appropriate, and those first responders should know, you know, this regimen, but and be trained in it. I'm sure they are. The administrative sanctions, I mean, this, by taking it out of the law, doesn't mean they wouldn't be not subject. So, but I think it would, I understand your concern. So, I don't know if it's fundamental to the uniformity here. Is Judge.
Then Chair, members of the committee. In everything the first responders do, they're subject to discipline as an employee that they did something wrong. The hypothetical you give of an overwhelmed situation with a lot of injuries and they overlook something, they're not going to be sanctioned. It's that's the kind of thing you've got. They've got a good defense. It's really just ordinary employer-employee circumstance.
Senator Limmer?
I didn't have a comment to this particular debate. Are we over with this particular subject?
We are.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I just recently had to renew my driver's license. And I can't remember on that yellow piece of carbon paper I get, you know, they clip your existing driver's license and you get a carbon one that states to any law enforcement officer that you're in the process of getting your new driver's license. And I believe the question is asked every time, do you intend to be a donor? And you X, I think there's a form on that. Now, if I altered or didn't fill that out in comparison to the previous driver's license notation and it was different, would that yellow carbon piece of paper and the subsequent new driver's license reflect that current wish as represented on my driver's license?
Madam Chair, I would think so.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that suffices for purposes of your license if you show it to a law enforcement.
And if let's say it was different, or if someone was wanting to change their intent, how long a time period does that take? In process.
Senator Limmer, do you mean how long does it take you to be able to change your driver's license?
To change the
notation on your driver's license?
Right.
Senator Limmer,
probably 6 weeks.
My driver's license will be due in June here, so I may have an answer for you. No, I don't know how long. I don't know if anybody else has practical experience.
The only question I'm raising is, let's say someone changes their intent and then they get in a tragic car accident, and which one does one follow
Madam Chair,
that category?
Committee members, I don't know for sure. I think this is a question for the Department of Public Safety, but I think it would take as long as it takes them to do whatever you put on that application form in the database. Mm-hmm. When we have a potential donor, we rarely check the hard copy of the license. We call DPS or we check the database itself. So as soon as that information is put in, it would be reflected.
I notice I keep going back to this page 4 on the reference to the donor's driver's license. We make an explicit reference to the driver's license, but in Section 6, when it comes to changing that intent, we're not referring explicitly to an altered or changed intent on a new driver's license. And is there a reason for that, or is it difficult to represent, or why wouldn't we explicitly represent an altered driver's license as a revocation reference?
Madam Chair, committee members, it's not noted. When you remove donor from your driver's license, it is equivalent to if you have never put it on. There's no record that it was on and taken off.
Madam Chair, do you get a new driver's license then? So if a first responder pulls out the old driver's license, do you get a new driver's license that no longer has an X on it?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, you do get a new driver's license, absolutely. You have to pay for it, unfortunately, but you do get the new one.
Okay.
We'll wait until your birthday.
Are there any further discussions on Senate File 883 as amended? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I've been trying to find the part in the bill that talks about what happens when the person dies. If you're a donor and it's on your license, you're a general donor, so you haven't specified particular body parts. Are we changing the law in here about how long the body can be kept for harvesting parts before it's turned back to the family for funerals and all that kind of thing?
Yeah,
what's the process for
Yeah, you? Madam Chair, committee members, that's a very good question, actually. This law, as it has been since 1968, is really about making and fulfilling gifts. So the donation process and how that's handled, the medical process and working with families, is really in federal statute and has to deal with our accreditation and the and not just us, but other procurement organizations and the process we follow at that time.
What is it?
Senator Neville.
What is the donation process?
What does the law require you to do with respect to the body? And for example, if it was kind of an undesignated donation, could you keep the body indefinitely for research or for cadaver use at a medical school or something like that?
Yeah.
Under what circumstances
right.
can the family say, okay, you got your heart and your liver and the kidneys, now we want it back for burial?
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, committee members, as soon as organs and tissues are recovered, the body goes back to the morgue or the funeral home or wherever it would be had there been no donation. And it is our intention, and we do everything we can to not impact the funeral process at all so that the funeral could still happen in the same time frame that it would have happened without donation.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
You're saying that doesn't have to be in this bill because it's federal law already?
Correct.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, let me clarify one other sequence. I don't know if this is a change in the law or not, but under the Section 8, we're talking about preclusive effect and the barring. As I read that, if the person is a donor then and dies and he's never amended or revoked, nobody can revoke that after the fact. So that's the first rule.
Yes.
If he did revoke, it would still be possible for certain people after death to still become donors. They can overrule his revocation after the fact.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members,
Ms. Larson.
This bill very specifically differentiates and very clearly the difference between revocation versus
yes.
refusal. They could not
right.
overturn his refusal.
That's right.
And I'm just going to tell you a couple reasons why, situations that I've heard. We frequently have people who will revoke their designation because they think they can't donate. I'm 65 or I have diabetes. And so they take it off, but I wish I could donate. So it's in place so that we can't make a presumption about why somebody revoked.
Right.
And so then it does go to the family or that priority list to make the decision.
Okay, Madam Chair, that's how
Senator
I understood
Neville.
It. And but if the person has signed a refusal, nobody can overturn that. And then the part that I'm a little confused about is line 7.14. A revocation of a gift of a body part by a person other than the donor does not bar another person from. Can you give me a scenario under that paragraph D? What does that mean?
Judge Davis.
The Section 7 is refusal. Refusal is the saying that you're never going to be a donor. Revocation is undoing a gift that you've already made, but it's neutral as to the future.
Well, give me an example of how it would work under subparagraph D on line 7,
yeah.
page 714.
Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, this would be a situation if, for example, I took donor off my license and then I were to die, my husband can make the gift of donation. So he's the other person.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems like here the revocation is by a person other than the donor.
It's by family.
So the person has made a gift and somebody other than the donor revokes, but that doesn't bar another person from overruling the revocation.
Mm-hmm.
Who would that
be? Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, it's certainly hard to think of every scenario, but let's presume that somebody's child rips up their donor card and then their spouse decides to make a gift of donation. I think we're looking at potentially extremes, but that is written for that type of situation.
Hmm. Madam Chair, would this occur after the person's death, or either before or after? Is there anybody else on the committee that reads this differently than I do? 15. I'm confused on it.
Yes,
14
to 16. Mm-hmm.
Judge Davies.
Line 714 to 716 points up the difference between a revocation and a refusal. A refusal is you're not going to be a donor, and no one else can be a donor. And your decision not to be a donor because of your refusal is conclusive. But if it's simply a revocation of a gift, if you undo a gift that you've already made, that does not mean that you're against all donations. And that opens the door then for somebody else, parent, a spouse, to authorize the gift.
So in other words, Madam Chair, in other words, we could have two people other than the donor, two people who could have a differing view. One person would revoke, but another one could overrule.
if you want to undo the gift permanently and absolutely, then you do the refusal.
All right. I can envision some problems with that, but not enough to take it out, I guess. Not enough to move to take it out.
Please don't.
Well,
it's a basic structure of the act, is that the refusal is it's never used as a verb. It's always a noun.
Madam Chair and Judge Davies, I understand that. I don't think this paragraph has anything to do with refusals. This is talking about revocations. And the only people who can revoke other than the donor would be a healthcare agent or a guardian or somebody who was specifically authorized with by some other express document. So what happens if the person has a will saying, this is the person, my personal representative, and I got a healthcare directive that says somebody else? And so there are two people out there who have authority to revoke.
Then you go to the priority list.
Well, okay. Is there one?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It's on page 8.
Okay, so the healthcare agent would supersede. So let's say the healthcare agent is the one that revoked. Now, the language says another person who has authority can undo the revocation.
At that moment, the person with the highest priority has full authority if there's not been a refusal.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so implicit in that paragraph D is that a person with higher authority can overrule it.
Can say no, can say yes.
Okay.
Oh, it's a person of the higher authority.
Of the higher authority.
Where is that?
Well,
what? Earlier page.
Top of the page.
Number one trumps two, two trumps three, three trumps four.
Yeah, Madam Chair, page 7, line 35 says, in the order of priority listed. So that it looks like the agent, the healthcare agent, is even trumps the spouse. So the healthcare agent is first, the spouse, then adult children, parents, etc.
Do we want that?
But in most cases, the spouse would probably be the agent and would be making that decision.
Senator Scheid, I think in that section, I mean, what it feels to me like is that it allows consent shopping among the potential people who could potentially consent. I know that's not the intent, but it seems like it would allow that to happen. Perhaps there needs to be some language here to assert that the only time when a second person could act if that person is in a higher position of priority.
Madam Chair, I do have some explanatory language. I don't want to read it all here. It's a long paragraph. I'll share that with Senator Neville. I understand. I mean, I think that is confusing because it is two people other than the donor themselves, him or herself.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'm this section 9 seems to apply a priority list to people after death. Mm-hmm. And so I would assume that that's what would happen if there were two competing people, one trying to undo the revocation of the other. Then that means that ultimately the person with the higher authority can overrule them again. So they can, frankly, they can keep going back and forth till you get to the higher priority person with authority.
Senator Neville, what do you think of in the on line 15? It says by a person other than the donor does not bar another person, and then insert the reference to the priority list from making an anatomical gift of the body or part under that section.
Another person with a higher priority under section 9, something like that?
Yeah.
That might clarify it.
I think that would clarify it because it then takes you back to the priority list.
Madam Chair, committee members, and I might, not an attorney, might be getting confused on that, but you know, in some of these comments that Senator Scheid referred to, it alludes to, you know, what if there was an agent who revoked a declaration, then that agent is no longer the agent, or the agent dies, then the next person, and they're no longer the higher priority list because the agent was the highest.
Of course, but under that scenario, the agent would lose priority in the priority list because the agent is no longer on the priority list.
And then the spouse. Mm-hmm.
Senator Scheid, would you be amenable to
Madam Chair, yes, I think that clarifies it. I mean, I think it makes it easier for the person who doesn't know
the context of which we're talking about. I mean, if we're even confused around this table reading that, and we've had to spend this much time to discern that what we were looking for was actually hidden there was the priority list, I think we ought to just make it more explicit.
Chair, at the risk of putting my own language at risk that I should be defending better here, I'm thinking of a situation where an adult child, I mean, let's say they have priority, and they make a decision to revoke, but another child makes a decision to donate. That's what it looks like it refers to. Like, it might refer to that. And then there's nothing in here about flipping a coin. I mean, I don't mean to be ridiculous, but that, you know, what do you do if you get two children and they don't agree? And I should ask.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members, this is where that majority in a class comes in. For one thing, if one child revokes the gift, and again, going back to the presumption of why somebody would do that, sometimes we have family members who say, I don't want to make a decision. We've had spouses back off and let their adult children make it. So if an adult child, in a sense, revokes a gift, we may not understand why. And that doesn't preclude another adult child from making a gift. Then if we have disagreement, we go to that majority in a class.
Madam Chair.
Judge Davies.
I think the committee would be, their minds would be put at ease if they looked on page 7, lines 32 to 35, there's an obligation on the part of the organ procurement organization to start at the top, and the issue is who is reasonably available. Now, they can go to the next class. If somebody in the prior class cannot be contacted. But if they can be contacted, they have to start with the first group and work down until they find somebody.
I think we understand that. What we are trying to work through here is I mean, I'm hearing that you don't object to the cross-reference to priority list, but what you just then presented is that then perhaps another scenario where we would have to make another cross-reference to another section of the bill. I just, Senator Scheid, I know that
that is this section.
I think that if we leave this language as is, people who haven't participated in this discussion will have a difficult time interpreting what this means.
Madam Chair, I agree.
Yes, and we should try to make it clear, and if we need to do some cross-references to help guide the readers who are going to be reading and interpreting this piece of the statute. And Ms. Larson, I honestly think that this is not putting an impediment in your way. I think this is making your job easier by making the cross-references there so that, you know, what you're attempting to do here is to provide a roadmap to help families and in very stressful situations to, in a concrete way, help guide the decision-making process. And I think in this section, if we leave it fuzzy without doing the proper cross-references back to the decision-making schemes that you have put in place, I think we do this bill a disservice by not being clear.
Madam Chair, actually, I would agree with you, and I'm fine with that. It's just the language as to what that cross-reference is. And the way I heard it, I thought it was problematic, and maybe I heard it wrong, or we can – it's just – some edits.
Well, I think that it would. What I'm hearing is that we would not only we would need to not only cross-reference, you know, sort of the priority list, but you would also have to, in some way, cross-reference back to the decision-making process in the instance where you were talking about now a new set of facts with, you know, adult children who occupy this who are in the same class. And in the same priority, in that instance, of course, then, you know, you would resolve it by going to the majority decision, I think.
Yes.
So that's, I think, a second cross-reference. It's not, that doesn't negate the first cross-reference that I talked about in terms of the priority list.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Ms. Pontius pointed out that on lines 7.7 and 7.8, there's a cross-reference there to the priority list, and that we could use exactly the same language on line 7.15. So if you see, if the donor revoked, that's not a refusal and does not bar another person specified in section 09, which is the priority section. So we should take, I think, that same language and just move it down to line 7.15 and say, other than a donor, it does not bar another person specified in section A04 or A09. Mm-hmm. And I think that clarifies then that we want to tie into the same priority list. Does that work?
Madam Chair, yes. I think that's good.
Okay. Then I just move that change.
Senator Neville moves that amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted. Senator Limmer.
While we're on page 8, I wanted to bring our attention to line 12. This is that priority list, and the number 10, the 10th person, any other person having the authority to dispose of the decedent's body, who would that be? Or is there anyone?
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members, that would be the coroner. And that would be the same situation if there was a death and there were no family, no friends, nobody to speak of. They would have that responsibility.
Right. Would it be better to just state coroner rather than any other person?
Madam Chair,
Larson?
Senator Limmer, I don't think that would be necessary, and I'm not familiar enough with the law in terms of who the persons are who have authority to dispose of the body.
One question I did want to ask is on the category of line 9, this 8th person in priority versus line 10, you have an adult who exhibited special care and concern for the decedent at a higher ranking of persons that were acting as guardians of the person. And I was wondering why a guardian would be at a lower level of priority than someone that has simply exhibited special care. I'm assuming that special care might be a healthcare worker, but could that be confused with maybe a good neighbor that goes over and takes care of an elderly person
other.
And shows concern for them.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson?
Committee members, you're right. It was actually written as per the health care provider, but it could be used in the situation of a significant other. Or I think we can think of different situations where that might come into play.
But why do we have that individual having a priority over a legal guardian? I would think a legal guardian would have precedence simply because it's recognized somewhere in a documentation that says they have that special status.
Senator Scheid, a fiancé would fall into which category?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if guardian here means legal guardian.
Yeah, it does.
In a sense. Is it just generically mean that?
No, Madam Chair, it's a defined term here. So guardian means a person appointed by a court. So when you, in the definitional
so
section.
It does indeed mean that. So, and you're asking me.
Where would a fiancé fall into this?
Well.
Madam Chair, I think a fiancé would fall into number 8.
No. After the spouse.
Madam Chair, especially after the fiancé and they have lived together for 40 years.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Limmer makes a good point. Were you going to try to suggest a...
transposing.
Yeah, I mean, as I was looking at it, I think the guardian should be right under parents.
Oh.
Maybe before brothers and sisters, but... Yeah, you know, it's a person. Normally, once a guardian is appointed for somebody, you know, they have full legal capacity of the person and the estate. Oh no, just the person, I guess. Now, conservator does the money, but a guardian has full control over the person. And normally, that would either be appointed by a court or sometimes in a will they nominate individual themselves can nominate their guardian in a lot of cases.
I'm sure, Senator Neville, I was thinking more of transposing it between 8 and 9 and just simply changing the order. You brought up an interesting perspective on bringing it simply under beneath the spouse. My focus has always been perhaps the family should always be the one to be in the priority order first. A guardian is somewhat more of a formal but yet removed from family. However, I know that there's family members that sometimes are at odds, or you might have an estranged sibling that hasn't been around mom or dad for decades, and then all of a sudden at the deathbed they come home to say goodbye, and now they're all of a sudden a part of this discussion of what to do. I don't know where legal guardian fits in that category. Then I would think if you have an estranged children, then legal guardian should take precedence. But if it's not, if there is no estranged relationship between the children and the adult, or I mean the subject, then I think it should fall in number 8 rather than number 9.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, I think normally a guardian during the person's lifetime is the top person.
All right.
And so presumably they've got a pretty close relationship, either by court order or by petition.
All right.
And I wasn't suggesting you go right into the spouse. I was suggesting that it become number maybe just after parents, but above adult siblings.
Yeah.
I
can live with that.
Senator Scheid, do you have what do you think? Where should guardians be? Legal guardians.
Madam Chair, I didn't have so much objection between 8 and 9. Remember, we're creating here a uniform act. I think that if we start reordering this dramatically, it has an impact as they work with other states.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move an amendment, oral amendment, that we simply transpose the two items between 8 and 9, moving the number 9 reference to line 8.9 and the reference to an adult who exhibited special care below and take up the place of number 9.
Judge Davies.
I would really like to speak against that suggestion. What you're doing by doing that is taking somebody who's through the formality of the law put in given responsibility for someone who cannot take care of themselves for some reason or another. But you're putting that legal agent ahead of somebody who may have lived with that person for 30 or 40 years, for all you know.
Well, Madam Chair, Judge, perhaps the problem is that we don't have a definition of who exhibited special care and concern. And that's the difficulty. You're making a reference that it might be a live-in relationship. I could think of a special neighbor that comes over and opens the door and says, Mildred, are you still in here? Did you wake up for and take your pills? That's a different relationship. And so, but we could all say they exhibited special care and concern. So I think due to lack of definition, I don't think I would want to have that supersede legal guardian.
Madam Chair, I think you've got something there. The one issue when you keep talking about the guardian, though, is in some of those statutes that's a conservator, and there are other titles for the individual that may very well have in a health care directive or in a will. And so you would want to have some clarity there, to use something like that. I've got another thing that I thought I wanted to bring out, but didn't. That's on line 12, 8, 12, number 10. And it says on there, any other person having the authority, I would be inclined to strike the and insert the word lawful.
Senator Foley, if you can hold off on that. I think Senator Limmer, did you move that change, Senator Limmer? Senator Limmer's motion is on the table. So, Senator Scheid, any thoughts?
Madam Chair, I could go either way on that. I'm going to let the committee decide that. I think an adult who exhibited special care and concern is a little vague. I think I know what it means, but I understand wanting to put guardian ahead of that. I don't agree with putting guardian ahead of any family members, but I think that I don't think it does terrible damage.
Right, and Senator Limmer's motion to transpose transpose 8 and 9. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
No. The motion does prevail. Now on your motion, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I didn't offer it as a motion. I merely threw it out as a suggestion that it seems to me that would clarify it. But if you want a motion, I'll so move.
Line 8.12?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you repeat what you would like, Senator Foley?
On line 10, strike the word of the and insert lawful in there. So it would read any other person having lawful authority to dispose of the decedent's body in the hope that would target the medical examiners or other types of
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think it clarifies it. I mean, at first I thought it was redundant, and I thought, no, I think he's right. It clarifies.
Any other further discussions on Senator Foley's motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I'd like to clarify one other sentence on page 10, line 21. This talks about, I guess this is in the section where we've got the entity that's going to be accepting the gift. The last sentence says, for purposes of this paragraph, the person who knows that a gift was made is also deemed to know of any amendment or revocation on the same gift. So does this mean, it means that there's a duty then to do some checking. You're going to be responsible and liable if you take the organs and there was an amendment or revocation because you're going to be deemed to have known that. What does that sentence mean?
Ms. Larson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members, I think you're correct. We are deemed to do due diligence and find out if there was a document of gift and if there was a refusal to make that to make a gift and to follow the information that we have.
So, Madam Chair, is the effect of that sentence that if you harvest organs from a body that where the gift had been revoked, that's intended to create liability?
Madam Chair, no, it's not, because a revocation is not a refusal to make a gift. So if someone revokes a gift, there is no gift, and that's when we go to the priority list of who can make a gift after death. We would be liable if we just said, okay, let's, go ahead. That could never happen, but it puts us in the place that no gift is made.
Because under the definition of revocation, revocation happens, is the process after death. So the individual affected wouldn't ever be in a position where that individual revokes. It would be in a situation where the individual refuses, but the revocation wouldn't ever be by the donor himself or herself.
Madam Chair, actually, it could be, but the revocation wouldn't be a refusal. A revocation is a more ambiguous act. So, again, a revocation might be, like Senator Limmer said, in my lifetime or the donor's lifetime, they took that donor designation off of their driver's license. That is a revocation, but that is not a refusal to make a gift. Right. And this law is very clear about that, and it also is very consistent with the Advanced Healthcare Directive law that also says a revocation of an Advanced Healthcare Directive, there's no presumptions about what the individual meant by that revocation.
So,
Madam Chair,
let me ask this question. I understand. I'm beginning to get a gleam of clarity on this. I mean, when something happens to an individual, even if they don't have explicit language saying that, on their driver's license or in their directive, in the instance of the witness we had here today, in their instances, I mean, they went back to what their son had talked about, but under that, in a separate situation where that conversation never took place, the parents could say, in memory of our son, we choose to exercise specific donations. That's a situation then where the revocation might come into place, because let's say it's not the parents who are there, but say the sister is there who says, I exercise that, right? The parents come in and say, no, you can't do that. We have priority. That's the revocation, even though the person has never explicitly themselves given permission one way or the other. The individual is silent in this instance.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct. What we have a system in our country called opt-in. And nobody is a donor unless they or their loved one choose to be. So if they don't have a donor designation, they're not a donor. If they die in absence of a donor designation, then the only way they become a donor is if someone in that priority list authorizes that. Now, in the situation of the witness, her son had documented his wishes to donate. Because he was a minor, his parents didn't have to fulfill that, but they chose to. In fact, in our state, 60% of the people who die and extend life after death did not designate their wishes to donate. It's coming from a consent by another person.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Could you ever have a tie?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, can you give it, what do you mean by a tie?
Well, if you had a list of the
twins.
Let's say children. No one else was living, but you had two adult children. One wanted, one did not.
Yes, Senator Limmer.
That would be a no.
Madam Chair,
right.
There are. It has to be a majority. So if you have two adult children, if you have two parents and one says yes and one says no, there probably would not be a donation. We would sit down with the parents and try to talk through it, sure. But in all likelihood it wouldn't happen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Tell me again why you have to be deemed to know of the revocation then. I don't know that I understood your answer before. Why? Tell me why that language is significant.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, committee members, you know, I understand why we need to be deemed to know of an amendment or a refusal or a document of gift, a revocation. I think it's in the best interest to try to understand what decisions were made in the person's lifetime, but it is possible that we would not be aware.
Well, am I correct that that sentence has the effect of forcing you to do due diligence after the fact, even if you have knowledge that the person is a donor, you still got to check? Because if you're wrong and the person had revoked and you didn't get permission from anybody else in the priority list, then you'd be liable.
Yeah.
And if that's not true, then why do you need that sentence? I don't understand it.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville, I apologize. I got a little bit lost in your scenario what the situation would be, but...
Well, Ms. Larson, I think that Senator Neville is asking a helpful question because while it is good that you place the burden on yourself to do the checking and do the due diligence, in an instance where you did your due diligence, but you couldn't find the information. And so subsequent to the fact that a specific piece of organ had been harvested and already transplanted, somebody objects and says, this was here, they did their due diligence, we don't care how well they did it, but they didn't find it, you know, and a lawsuit ensues. Does this somehow unintentionally then imposes liability on you, and to what extent?
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Judge Davies, except that I will say there is an immunity section in this bill.
Well, why don't you take us to that section?
Section 18 is the immunity for those who work in the field of donation and transplantation, saying as long as they attempt in good faith, there's no liability.
Senator Neville, does that answer your...
Madam Chair, I don't know a lot about deeming law. I only know that in ERISA law, there's this concept called deeming that is sometimes applied when the employer makes a discretionary call. But that's the only place I know about the concept of deeming. And here we are deeming that the recipient of the person means the organization that's getting the part. So you have, that's a defined term. The term person is a defined term. So you know that there was a gift. So you have actual knowledge, let's say from the driver's license, that the person's a donor. So you got actual knowledge of that. But you're deemed to know if there was an amendment or revocation anyway. So if there was one, you're going to be deemed to know about it, which I assume has the effect of forcing you to do some investigation after the fact, and if you make a mistake, I mean, presumably if you find out there's a revocation, you're going to have to go to the priority list and get an approval after the fact. But if you don't do that, and you go ahead, even in good faith, you're still deemed to have known about the revocation, aren't you?
Judge Davies.
Deemed to know means you're charged with knowledge. But the key thing here is line 24. where it says on the same document a gift. It means they have to read all the way to the end.
Deemed to have any manner of revocation of a gift, or any refusal to me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to the scenario where an individual revokes the donor. It seems to me that there should be no authorization to do that by any of those other people on the list there. If I don't want to donate and cancel it on my driver's license, I don't think it should be done, because that's my consent in the last action, if you will.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, as I'm reading, are we still we're still talking. I've been reading here a little bit. This is Senator Neville's concern about page 10 and those lines 21, 22, 23 there. And I'm looking at some explanatory language. As you read to the end of that sentence at 10:24, all of this refers to the same document of gift. So what I want to say, I just want to read something to you. Suppose the decedent's children wish to donate organs, okay? Good. Then to LifeSource. But LifeSource knows that the spouse exists and is reasonably available, then they may not accept that gift from the children. So, because they know, well, that's improper. Then, because of the imputed knowledge requirement in the last sentence, the organization may not accept that gift if on the same document of gift, which is like your driver's license, there is evidence that that gift was revoked. So I think that it's important to look at on the same document of gift.
Well, Madam Chair, it's not on the same document. Document of gift is a defined term. So the document of gift could be the driver's license. So it could be on your driver's license, but the revocation could be by a separate handwritten document delivered to the registrar. So if there has been a revocation, now you're deemed, you have imputed knowledge of that, even though it doesn't show up on the driver's license. You have imputed knowledge of that. So I think with that, the effect of that sentence is because you will be imputed with the knowledge of the revocation, even if it isn't apparent, you've got a duty now to go out and investigate. Even though the card says, I am a donor, you better go check to make sure there's been no revocation. Is that the intent of that sentence?
Madam Chair, I think Senator Neville's right about what I was saying. So,
Judge Davis.
I think it's just one of those places where there was a little excess of caution, but I think we can all live with it.
Yeah. I just want to – the reason I'm asking the questions is I want to clarify, because that sentence is going to be litigated someday vis-a-vis the immunity clause. Mm-hmm. And so on the one – you're going to say I've got immunity because I was acting in good faith. Somebody else is going to say you were deemed to have knowledge of the revocation and you took the parts anyway. And so what happens? That's the issue I'm trying to resolve. What happens?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know. I'm not an attorney. I can't answer that. But if we had knowledge of a refusal, we couldn't recover organs. Well, we'd be in big trouble.
Madam Chair,
if we had knowledge of a revocation, go to the priority list, because a revocation is not a refusal.
I understand.
Well, Ms. Larson, I think so. I think this is something that, unless Senator Neville has a solution for you, y'all have to think about it a little bit. And, you know, I know Mr. Cassidy's sitting back there and Senator Scheid, and y'all can kind of think this through a little bit. It's, I don't think this discussion is necessarily hostile. I think it's good, actually, for you to think this through a little bit and how we, if that language could be tweaked a little bit to achieve what we want, which is to give you the burden of having to do the due diligence, mm-hmm. but don't absolutely, you know, deem that or impute that onto you, because obviously the immunity section implies that, you know, so long as you in good faith do your due diligence, then you get off. You know, you get off, or you're not being held liable. So mm-hmm. we just want to make sure that we're consistent in the language with what you want in practice.
Well, Madam Chair, just to make it clear, I'm not suggesting changing the language. I'm just trying to find out on the record what the intent is, because I think that clause is going to be litigated someday. So maybe there should be a little legislative history on what its intent is, mm-hmm. or just how it works. The way I'm interpreting it, I want to keep it. Okay. I want to put the burden on you mm-hmm. to do your due diligence. Even if the donor card, even if the driver's license says I'm a donor, I want you to double check after and you said before that you do, mm-hmm. that you always go to the registry. And so you will know, you know, and presumably if you do that due diligence after the fact, then you're acting in good faith and you'll get the immunity. So I think we're okay, but I was just trying to get you to say that.
Well,
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, for the record, there's a situation where I personally did research over to the History Center to get that to take court to solve a Supreme Court hearing. And so there is a possibility of having what this committee does, because that's what I did. I listened to committee notes until I found the right one and then used that data. So I think in order to satisfy Senator Neville, that ought to be adequate to deal with the issue. I think we beat a dead horse to death there, and that
I'm satisfied.
We should move forward.
So, Senator,
any
other discussions?
Always amended on the floor.
Yes. Senator Limmer?
Yeah.
Yes.
We have given a lot of time and attention to this bill.
Yes, we have.
And when a member on this committee amends it on the floor, there has to be a really good reason, given how much participation we give in this committee to bills. So, Senator Scheid, what is your wish?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill as amended, but I would also like to say I've noted where I ought to be working. Well, I will be working with Senator Betzold on the donor registry piece, and I have a couple of sections, but it sounds like Senator Neville is fine with this language. But I think in Section 8, the lines 14 to 16, I had made a note that you had some concern there. So I will work with him regarding that.
Thank you. Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 883, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any member of the audience wishing to testify on this bill before we send it off? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Chair Committee, thank you. Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you.
Members, I apologize. I was hoping we'd get you all out of here a little bit faster. Tomorrow morning, I thought there was going to be a conflict with taxes. Apparently now taxes is meeting in the morning and not in the evening. So we will pick up our, again, listen to and staff and public, whoever out there, people can, you know, spread the word, but we'll try to start, you know, half an hour after session ends again. We'll pick up the agenda where we left off tonight, and then we'll move on to the bills that we have on the list tomorrow. What we don't finish tomorrow, or if for some reason we end up going too late in the session, we end up not having a meeting, those items that have already been posted will stand, and we'll find some time to make it through the agenda. Senator Lemmer?
Oh, Madam Chair, it's been difficult at times to follow which bills come up with limited posting. I know it's difficult to do when it comes to deadlines, but any advance notice, more than 1 day, 2 days, would be helpful for us so that we could be more prepared for committee.
Yeah, and I apologize, members. We're trying very hard to do that, and up until now, it's been a lot of the re-referral bills that had budgetary implications. Really, it's only been this series of bills that we've had this very busy week in the evenings that are really policy bills that in our jurisdiction that we know we want to get through. And so I apologize for that, but we've tried to post them. The only bill that haven't been fully posted for a couple of days, so your concern is noted. And the only bill I think that was on today's agenda that hadn't been posted for a couple of days was the Linda Higgins bill, which was already on the floor, or there were some issues and we had to get it turned around, and Senator Scheid wanted to just take that language off. But we will definitely try to give as much notice as possible. You know, as things get a little bit hectic, there will be a lot of changing of the agenda, but we will try to stick to as much of the posting of the time as we can, and we'll let you know when changes do take place. So thank you. Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, it is a hardship for some of us to come when we don't have a scheduled hearing. And so we have scheduled times for our hearings, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and so when you add them on Mondays and Wednesdays, it's particularly important to know what's on the agenda, because sometimes members have conflicts during that time, including myself. And so when I called on Monday to find out what was on the agenda for today, I couldn't get an answer to that. It was unknown. And so I would appreciate just a little bit more notice. And if we're going to have committees outside of our regularly scheduled meeting, I'd like to think that we're all coming because there's a really big purpose, not just one bill.
Duly noted. We are adjourned.